Hey, whenever you're ready, Candace, I'm ready. I'm rocking and rolling and full of gratitude.
Excellent. Welcome to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for solopreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. I'm your host, Candace Rodarte, and today we're joined by comedy entrepreneur R. Scott Edwards
is what she's about to say.
I'm your host, Candace Rodarte, and today we're joined by comedy entrepreneur R. Scott Edwards. Scott opened his first comedy club at the age of 24. He helped develop the careers of many famous comedians, including Bob Saget, Jerry Seinfeld, and Gary Shandling. He has produced 3 TV series, several large concerts, and thousands of live comedy stage shows. He is now sharing his knowledge and experience through his books, online courses, podcasts, and video archives, y'all. We're going to talk about that. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, you did a great job, Candace. You got through it all. It's not an easy intro. I've kind of been in a lot of things, a lot of fingers in different pies. I'm a solopreneur that's started over a dozen companies. So, you know, you start talking about what I've done, it gets crazy.
Complicated, but fun, I'm sure. So tell us your story. With all that, how did you get to where you are today?
Well, I'll give you the short version of the story. Started my first company at 17. It was a small construction company. Then it went into disco, whoop, whoop, taught dancing and stuff. When I was 24, I started a chain of comedy clubs called Laughs Unlimited, all comedy showroom in Northern California. It opened in August of 1980. It was the 12th full-time comedy club in the country at the time. I sold it in 2001, but it is still operating. So now it's one of the oldest clubs in the country. My very first act, opening act on stage, making $150 for a week, was Gary Shandling. His very first gig out of his hometown of Phoenix, Arizona. And the headliner was the mayor of Vegas, George Wallace. Great guy who introduced me to a lot of people. But the very next week, the guys that kind of got me going and got me started were Dave Coulier and Bob Saget, and lots of great stories there. But I went on after that. I had a travel agency. I was a fleet director for a Ford store. I just sold and retired out of my insurance brokerage. And I had a couple restaurants. I've had a couple art galleries. Oh, did I mention I owned a submarine? So I've kind of done a lot of different things.
There's so much to touch base there. Okay, let's cover Bob and Dave before. So they actually knew each other before they had a TV show together.
Right. I had met Kuye when I had gone down to the satellite store of the Comedy Store right off of UCLA University in Westwood. There was a little nightclub. I'd gone there on vacation and checked it out. Said this was amazing. I'd never seen live stand-up comedy. A lot of people hadn't back in 1980. And I drove back to Sacramento, quit my job, went bankrupt, did anything I could to clear the decks. And I opened my own comedy club in August of 1980. And the rest is history, as they say. But Dave Coulier and Bob Saget were really the guys that took me under their arms and taught me, you know, how to treat the comics, what to charge for the shows, you know, the best way to produce a show. So I ran what's called an A room, Candace, and that is a 3-act format with the headliner always being a full professional, somebody that was like right on the verge of fame and fortune. And I was lucky to end up working with quite a few, not only Dave Coulier and Bob Saget, but Dana Carvey got his start at my club. Ray Romano worked for me. Jay Leno worked for me. Jerry Seinfeld, Paula Poundstone. It goes on and on. And then I had unique situations where Tommy Chong from Cheech and Chong fame came in. Graham Chapman from Monty Python. Soupy Sales for your older audience. Pat Paulson was a good friend of mine. So owning a comedy club does open up the doors to some great stories and memories.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the submarine. Tell me about the submarine, and then I want to go backwards for a minute, but let's talk about the submarine before I forget.
Well, just to share with other entrepreneurs that when you're succeeding, and I was doing quite well in the 80s, I took my 3 comedy clubs And I took the money from that and I opened a couple art galleries and I opened a couple restaurants. And the opportunity came up with a company I was already invested in called Snuba, which is underwater snorkeling. It's all around the world. And the owners of that said, hey, we just built this submarine. We need help launching it at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Can you come help us? So I flew over and I'm helping them do the final touches to the submarine. And I go, man, this is cool. I got to get one of these. So then they built a couple more. And then Nautilus 4 was mine. I launched it in Monterey, California. It was a beautiful tourist submarine where people could experience the sea otters and the sea lions and the kelp forest. And it was a huge, Candace, I'm telling you, huge financial disaster for me. I lost my butt on that one. The problem was Monterey had cold water where there was a problem with algae bloom. And so we had to actually pay a scuba diver to go along and keep the windows clean so that people could see the sea life. It was a financial failure. We ended up selling the boat to the Wrigley Gum family, and it's still operating out of Catalina Island in SoCal.
That sounds like a better location.
It's done great down there. The Nautilus 4, go down, check it out. It runs off of Catalina, and they've had huge success with it. But, you know, live and learn. And I get the great story of saying, you know, hey, I owned a submarine.
Yeah. I love it. So I'm from Monterey. And cool. It's not great warm place. There. No. You know, people always think about, ooh, sunny California. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sunny
not
for,
by
you
the
know,
ocean. Yeah,
sunny for
by
a couple ocean. Hours.
Right. You get the fog in the morning and then, it's a different climate altogether. But I really love Monterey. It's got one of the best aquariums in the country. The people are great. And the little bay there is amazing. In fact, for those who don't know, Monterey Bay is one of the deepest inlets along the coast of California, and I think in the United States, and thus the reason for the variety of fishery and sea life and all that.
Yeah, it's got a lot of variety of animal life and sea life and plants and people. It's got a good variety of people there too.
Yeah.
It was a fun place to live when I was younger.
You're all about marketing and branding. And what I would share with your listening audience after listening to Vicky and Steve and some of the interviews you've done is that what's the best way to share your vision, your business that you're excited about with others? You know, like I loved stand-up comedy and I got to share it through my comedy clubs. I like good food, so I got to share that through my restaurants. I'm a big aficionado of art, so I opened a couple of art galleries. I'm a big fan of the ocean, so owning a submarine and being involved in Snuba and Subsea Systems, who built the submarines, was a real thrill for me. And there's two important things that I think were the takeaways for me. And that is do something that you're passionate about and then find a way to share it with the general public. And then two, a lot of people think you have to be rich and be bankrolled real heavily for these kind of adventures. And some of them, that's true. But many of my businesses, I started with just ingenuity, the seat of my pants, and luck.
And connections. Because like you said at the beginning, Bob and Dave taught you how to treat the comedians. They taught you what to do. And without them, you may have made some mistakes. So you had some mentorship and some guidance. And I'm sure in exchange for that, you offered them a platform where they could be hilarious.
Oh, yeah. And Candace, going that direction, I think you hit the nail on the head. Ding, 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 ding. It's so important to listen to the people that do it. I help some young entrepreneurs through some training and through some programs I've put out there. But one of my biggest tips for people that want to get into business, that want to be an entrepreneur, is there's no reason to recreate the wheel. Go out and talk to people doing it. Before I opened my first construction company at age 17, and by the way, that makes it sound like a big deal. It was like me and two high school buddies, and we painted lines in parking lots. But we grew, and we had staff, and we ended up doing more than lines. But before I started, I went and talked to guys that ran huge companies doing asphalt work and line painting and stuff. People love to talk about themselves, especially how they got started and their success. So I'd go right up and, you know, hey, I'm really impressed with your business. I'd like to do something similar. Where do you get your paint? How much do you charge for a line? How did you get started? And if you do it in a graceful, polite way, people love to share. Those kind of marketing connections that you talk about on your shows, Candace, is so important.
Mm-hmm. Well, in collaboration too, that other company may have needed to subcontract you at some point.
You know, you never know what relationships might be built. Like I mentioned, I was a partner in a SNUBA, which is underwater snorkeling, and that led me to get involved with Subsea Systems, where I was able to own a submarine. And I didn't want to sound braggy, but I also ended up owning a beach shack in Hawaii for 5 years. And I got that through the people I met through these other companies. In comedy, what was amazing is back in 1980, it was a pretty close-knit family. And so Bob Saget introduced me to George Wallace, who introduced me to Jay Leno, who introduced me to, you know, blah, blah, ended up Robin Williams getting on my stage. I mean, you never know where it's going to take you.
It's exactly the same with a podcast. One guest leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and you never know who is going to introduce you to somebody amazing.
Well, if you could just get somebody from the Vatican, you'd be the top of the list. I mean, that would be like the cat's meow. That'll never happen, right, Candace?
I have interviewed somebody from the Vatican.
Oh, wow.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
You are the Kilimanjaro of podcasters. That's amazing.
I know.
See, ladies and gentlemen, as long as you just aren't afraid to ask, put yourself out there. And I think it's key, and Candace, I think you'd agree, it's always important to be respectful, polite, and bring some joy to whatever conversation you're in.
Exactly. Respectful and polite and open-minded. Because a lot of times you're going to interview people who have different viewpoints than you do.
No, that never happens.
Never, yeah. And you, if you are open-minded and you have a polite, courteous conversation, that teaches other people how to have a courteous and polite conversation.
Well, and also I've listened to several of your podcasts, and you've had some amazing people, Karina and Amy and Maya. I mean, you've had some great women on there. By the way, I was kind of surprised I made it on the show. I don't know if you realize you've had way more women on the show than men. There's been like three, I think I'm the fourth guy in the last, you know, 5 years, and all these really talented business smart women. But
that is not true. I interview an equal amount of men and women.
It's not important. Success is what matters. And I will tell you that women communicate better than men in general. That's a broad statement, I know. But I found it interesting that all the people you interview find a way to not only share their passion and teach those around that are listening, but they do it in a respectful way that is helpful to everybody. And I think that's where you bring together, Candace, that relationship building that's so important. And I'll give you a quick example. I've used relationship building my whole career as a salesman. I'm basically a salesman. In my last business, an insurance brokerage, I specialized in small business insurance. I would literally walk door to door and meet business owners and have talks with them. I wasn't trying to sell them. I just wanted to get to know them. And by the way, you know, I do insurance. If you ever have a question or need, and 9 times out of 10, they had a question or something. And by the way, do you know anybody else that might need or have a problem with insurance? What I found is when you're a salesman, you want to be successful, you really want to be a problem solver. And that means you need to listen. And so many salespeople, and I'll do the stereotypical used car guy, you know, you want to buy a car today, you know, want to buy a watch. And they're pushy. And really successful salespeople and successful entrepreneurs know when to ask the right questions and then shut up and listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I have a funny sales story to share. I don't know if I've ever shared it on the podcast before, but you've never heard it, so I'm going to tell it to you. I was 26 years old, so I was young. And I was looking for a new car. I needed a new car. I lived in Houston, Texas, and my car didn't have air conditioning. I had moved there from California. I was driving a convertible that didn't have air conditioning. There is no need to have, one, a convertible in Houston, two, to have no air conditioning in your car in Houston. So I was looking for a new vehicle, and I test drove a car at a car lot, and the salesperson and I, he was a little older than me, and we were having a great conversation. And by the time the conversation had ended, I'd already seen his pierced nipples.
Okay, that might be sharing too much.
And so I didn't quite want the car that he had shown me. So I went to the lot next door on my way out, and I bought a car from the lot next door. And the next morning he called to follow up with me, as a good salesperson should. And I said, that was probably the most interesting sales experience I've ever had, that I purchased a different car.
Yeah, well, you went from the guy with the pierced nipples and bought from the guy with the pierced nose. So, but, there is such a thing as sharing too much. But I think he missed the point that he was sharing so much with you. He never found out your real needs, your real desires, would have facilitated the vehicle that you needed, and he needed to listen more. Hopefully, and it sounds like the second salesman was a little bit more aware of what Candace needed, wanted, and could afford. And that's when you put together the best vehicle for whatever situation. I can't tell you how many times I was on a car lot, and a guy comes in with his wife and three little kids, and he goes, "Man, show me the Mustangs. I want to see a Dodge Charger or a Mustang." And I'm going, well, and then while I'm walking him out, what are you going to be using it for? "Well, we got to take the kids to school. We have soccer practice at night. We have all the neighborhood kids." "Oh, well, we need to do this." So as I'm walking, I'm asking the right questions and listening. And then when we get to the Mustang, I go, "These are really neat, but right over here, there's this van." And he goes, "I never want a soccer mom, man." And I go, "Well, I understand, but here's why you need it." And then point out I echo back everything he told me. You have to take your neighbor's kids. You have to take your kids. You have these chores. Your wife needs to use it. Go to the store. If you can afford it, you get a sports car for you, but your family needs this van. And 9 times out of 10, I sold it.
You're a pretty good salesperson, but sometimes the person is stubborn. So my mom, 1976, I think, is when she bought this little 280Z. I was 76. I was 6 or 7 years old. My older sister was 10 or 11, and my younger sister was 3 or 4, right? And this 280Z two-seater car was my mom's car. My dad took the four-seater, the sedan, to work. And when we went to the grocery store, my little sister and I sat in the back of the hatchback with no seats, and my older sister sat in the front, and then we sat there with the groceries. This was in the 70s, so there was no seatbelt laws.
Well, I don't think mom was being too aware of the situation, mostly because she didn't have to sit back there. But in anything in business, whether you're selling comedy or art or food or insurance, it's all about presenting the product that a customer needs in fulfilling their need, desire, their problem.
And I want to caveat to that, though, because I'm married to an artist, and my daughter's an artist, and my mother was an artist, and my grandmother was an artist. So I want a caveat on art. Make the art you love for yourself. There will be people who buy it.
Oh, yeah. I had two different art galleries. One, I was a kind of an expert. I wrote a book on it, on animation, cartoons. And then my other one was more eclectic, and it was Northern California art. But occasionally people would come in and go, "I want to buy something that's going to be worth something in 5 or 10 years. And I go, "Stop. That's not the way to buy art. You got to buy what really sings to you, what means something to you, what relates to you. Because when it's up on your wall, you want it to bring emotion to you. You don't want to be look at some picture and go, "Oh, I bought that because it might be worth more in a few years." That's not the right way to buy art. Art is an expression of the artist. And then, as you said, Candace, you have to find the people that can relate to that piece of art and want that in their house to represent them.
Yeah. And usually art has a story too. I mean, if you're purchasing art and not prints, and if you're purchasing art, right, art that has a story, you may have met the artist. You may have spent an evening in a gallery and had a good time. You know, you may have mingled with somebody who knew somebody, you know, there, or the painting is of a place that you remember going to. My father is an art collector, and he has a painting in his home in of a location where when we were little, we all went skinny dipping in this, well, the kids, we all went skinny dipping in this lake. And he has a painting of this lake. And I don't know about my sisters, but I don't care what else I get from him when he dies. I want that painting.
Yeah.
That, you know, that, because it has a story.
Right. And it means something to you. There's an emotional reaction. So I mentioned I dealt in animation art. And when you're dealing in animation, we're talking about Casper, the Friendly Ghost, Bugs Bunny, Mickey Mouse. When you see those images, it brings you back to your childhood. It brings you back a moment of joy. I have a few cells from Yellow Submarine, the Beatles movie, that, you know, brings me back immediately to their music. And when I first time saw that, Tinkerbell from Peter Pan, you know, those kind of images are around my house, and they bring me, they make me smile because it brings me back to a moment of joy. And I think that that's what art is. But to your point, right above my fireplace is an original oil by an artist out of San Francisco named Kakaro. He was pretty popular in his day. There was a Time Life book on him and stuff. But the story was, my mom and dad were cruising through the park area, and the artist, who was a nobody at the time, was out there painting, and they bought this because it meant something to them, and it represented their trip as a couple to San Francisco. When both my parents have passed on, Kakaro's long gone, but that painting still has a story, still has meaning through the family history. And then if you go to Time Life books, you can find the history of the artist Kakaro and learn about him, which I did. I think art is really a reflection, a mirror of who we are, or what we want.
I haven't hung it yet, because I haven't figured out where to stick it on my wall yet. But the painting above my my shoulder to the left of me was painted by my father's Aunt Marie. And my middle name is Marie, after her. Oh, so cool. This little painting, and it's of Central Park, you know, that she painted it in Central Park when she lived in New York City, when she was in her 40s, maybe. So the painting's 50 years old or more, 60 years old. And it just has, it has no monetary value.
Oh, no, but it means something
to you. But it means something to me.
Well, you mentioned that, Candace, and we've kind of talked about a lot of different topics, but when it comes to art, as an art curator, as a guy that owned art galleries, I think, again, it's that relationship with the image that's so important. So in my house, it's not, yes, I have a couple expensive oils, and I have several original animation cells, but I have cheap-ass posters that mean something to me from, like, the Jefferson Airplane, or you can't see it, but over my shoulder is one of the original Democratic posters from Kennedy's running for president. So whether it's a cheap poster, a piece of animation that nobody ever saw but me, doesn't mean anything to anybody but me, or a hand-painted oil or watercolor, it's the imagery, that not the value of the piece. The mm-hmm. value of the piece is in your heart.
Yep.
It's the imagery that I think that you relate to that shares so much. But boy, we've gone way off base on business and marketing.
No, not really, because art is business.
Well, for me, it was.
Yeah, art is business. I mean, my husband makes a living from art.
Oh, well,
and he has for over 30 years. For the first, when I met him, he was a professional furniture maker, and I'm kind of smart. So, and I had some marketing savvy. So I turned his local custom furniture business into a nationwide network of retail stores that were selling his furniture in 25 different states.
Yeah, and I read then, about you. Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. And then, but he is a craftsman. He is an artist. He makes beautiful hand. Every single piece of furniture he made was unique and one of a kind, even if it was something similar to something that somebody else wanted. Right. And now he does, paintings and drawings, and he sells paintings and drawings, but he's always been an artist. It's just, you got to have someone who knows how to market it. You got to have that broker. You got to have the somebody to separate you from the art so that you can produce the art and then somebody can find a market for it.
I think it's been proven over and over again. It's very difficult to sell your own product. It's better to have a professional that understands how to find the right customer for that piece. I hate to be crass, but much like the car business, there's all these options, and it depends on what that individual buyer either needs or is looking for or a want. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to art, it's not usually a need. It's almost always a want or a bonus. It's like, mm-hmm. I want to treat myself in life to something that means something to me. That's what art is. Yeah. It's an emotional connection. And tell your husband, what he's accomplished is not easy. Even owning art galleries, which I had through most of the 80s and part of the 90s, were very difficult to keep open. I mostly kept them open at a loss just because I enjoyed it. And in fact, if I've mentioned the submarine and the comedy clubs and the art galleries, we haven't gone into the restaurant business, which is challenging in its own way. But these were all things I was passionate about, mm-hmm. that I really enjoyed or I thought would be fun to do. Not necessarily that they would make me rich or, change the world. That wasn't the point. The point was I had a passion. I wanted to share it. And I was, like you mentioned, looking for the right customers, looking for the right clients that connected with what I was offering.
That doing the thing that you love doing and finding the right customer for what you loved.
Exactly.
And that's the perfect combination.
Oh, that's the dream combination. I mean, I can't say when I owned my insurance brokerage that I had any sort of love for insurance. I didn't. I'm like everybody. I don't like insurance. I didn't when I sold it. But it has a necessity in our society. And what I did like is communicating with the business owners and with the customers and protecting them and protecting their assets in the best possible way for the least amount of money. Yeah. And that's the sign, well, it sounds braggy, but of a good insurance broker. It wasn't about me getting rich. It was about taking care of my customer. And if I took care of my customers, like you said, what do? They refer you.
Exactly. They refer you.
Build your business. Right.
And they give you testimonials and all sorts of good stuff. If you take care of your customers take care of you. Let's talk about insurance for a second.
Candace, about Vicky, she mentioned it, and that's branding. So all the solopreneurs or entrepreneurs, it's good to get a monogram, good to brand yourself. So for those that haven't heard of me, I was Scott, the insurance pro. So whenever I walked in the bank or a gas station or a restaurant, everybody would go, "It's Scott, the insurance pro," because I branded the hell out of that.
Scott has mentioned Vicky a couple of times. There'll be a link to interview with Vicky in the show notes. Vicky and I are actually very good friends. We see each other at least once a week. So,
awesome.
I don't interview a lot of my personal friends, but she's one. So,
good. So I sidetracked you. You were about to ask me something. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask you something. Oh, insurance. Since we're talking about it, and this conversation feels like it's going around in a lot of different directions, but insurance is something that you did, and we're talking about being an entrepreneur. So, what do most entrepreneurs not know about insurance?
That it is a necessity of successful business, and that even though it's part of your expense, you got to plan that. So before you open a business or in the beginning of your business, make sure that you plan for the expense of insurance. Now, the good news is it's not relatively expensive. People think, it's $1,000 for a year. That sounds like a lot of money when you're just getting started, but that usually includes $1 million in coverage. And what we're talking about is liability. So what I'll tell somebody that's just getting started, you know what? Take a little bit of risk. Don't insure your equipment and your, you know, your paperworks and some of that stuff right now. One, there's less value there. And two, you can protect it. But no matter what, from day one, you need that liability, because that is what can ruin your life. If you don't have liability and you cause injury, or you defame somebody, or you lose somebody else money because you didn't do something right, and you don't have liability insurance, they can come and take your business or take your house or take your future income. So liability insurance, which is not expensive in relation to what you're getting, is a must. And always talk to a professional before you do it.
People who think that they can start a business without investing anything are, it's kind of interesting. 25 years ago, so we're going to have to triple these prices because inflation is really high. 25 years ago, we spent $30,000 on the bare minimum equipment that we needed to have a furniture shop. That was the bare minimum. We got by with the bare minimum for $30,000.
That's an amazing story, and you built it to huge success. But I'll tell you that when I started my comedy club, which I built up into 3 stores, I had 130 employees. I worked with some of the best in the business and had huge success in the 80s and 90s. When I opened in August of 1980, I had wheeled and dealed my way into a free space. I was negative underwater. I'd had to borrow money from friends and whatever, Peter Paul, to pay, you know, the piper, to get by for the first 9 months. But, you know, once it clicked, it was great. But in the beginning, it was all seat of the pants. It was all without a huge investment. I had a little bit of sound equipment because my disco days.
You probably also had some chairs and tables.
Well, what I did is I wheeled and dealed my way into the banquet room of a big restaurant that already had all that. Ah. So all I had to do was pick up some theatrical lights and have a sound system. And then, boom, I was in business. As far as marketing and advertising, I'm old school. I was back in 1980, and I am today. I think that, yeah, social media is the greatest gift to free marketing. And there's no beating that. But still, putting up some small flyers and taking them out to gas stations and local restaurants and businesses near your business, or doing business cards, but not just the normal business card, something artistic that catches people's eyes, and getting those out there. And what I did with the comedy club is I printed up very cheaply some like 2-for-1 passes. And then I'd walk around and just give them all out, because the whole idea was to get people in to experience stand-up comedy. Now, remember, folks, this was 1980. Stand-up comedy was relatively new. In the 60s and 70s, stand-up comedy was mostly the break between jazz bands and strippers, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't a mainstream entertainment form until the late 70s and going into the 80s and 90s. Of course, by 1986, it was like Starbucks, and there was a comedy club in every corner because all the discos turned into comedy clubs. But at least I was ahead of the game.
I cannot remember the name of the comedy club, but I had never been to a live comedy show. So this was the mid 90s, and I lived in Oakland, Alameda, in the San Francisco Bay Area. And somebody gave me a buy one, get one free pass for a comedy club. So I invited a friend and we went. And then I was hooked. I was like, I wanted to go all the time after that. So it was it's a really great way to get people in the door.
Right, exactly. It's a great way to market and brand yourself. Also, getting that first person in, we hear a lot of stand-up comic on my podcast, on TV, on radio, but there's nothing like live stand-up comedy, that live performance energy where the audience is sharing a moment with the entertainer. Now, I was a pretty variety-based comedy club. I had magicians and ventriloquists and jugglers and you name it.
Sounds like fun.
Oh, it was a blast. But the key was that what happens in a live comedy show is that if the comic is a professional, that's the key. Some of these amateur nights when you're going out and you hear nothing but F-bombs, that's not stand-up comedy. That's some guy, I don't know. I don't want to say what it is. But if you go to a professional club, you know, Laughs Unlimited, the Punchline, the Last Laugh, the Comedy Store, the Improvisation, the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, There's a bunch back east. You're going to see professional entertainers. And when they get on stage and they connect with an audience, there's no feeling like that. I mean, it's just everyone's in it together. It's just amazing, incredible thing. And obviously, I'm still passionate about it.
Well, it seems like the comedians all get along with each other well, and it's a little family. They all know each other. No?
Well, it's like any industry. Yeah, the majority of them have a mutual respect as peers. But, you know, there's always, somebody stole this or somebody borrowed that, or somebody's gets that, you know, what I call the golden ticket and get a sitcom or get the Tonight Show. You know, back in the 80s and 90s, if you got on the Johnny Carson show with Johnny, Ray Romano's a great example. Almost overnight, you might have a show. You know, it was a special time for comedy.
Listener, this is for the listener. A lot of times potential podcast guests will send what's called a one sheet to a show host in order to pitch themselves to the show. That is not how I got my hands on Scott's one sheet, but I did get my hands on Scott's one sheet. And I normally do not ask questions from a one sheet because it tells us a little bit about the person and what kind of like questions to ask.
Show them. Business resume.
Yeah. You know, it's like a resume. Exactly. So I do not normally ask questions off of a one sheet because I want my questions to be unique and I want my interview to be different than everybody else's. But I got to know, why do you have a photo of Saget and Chandler in dresses? And and why would Republicans hate that?
Well, that's so funny. Times have changed, haven't they? So the story is, everybody, that I was very lucky. This was before they were famous, although Bob Saget and Dave Coulier were such good friends that even after Full House was out, they came back and worked my club a couple times. And Gary Shandling was very successful. He had the Larry Sanders Show, the Gary Shandling Show. He did a lot of movies. And we were his first road gig back in 1980. And so we were good friends and he worked for me a lot. And my main club was located in Old Sacramento, a touristy 1800s kind of cobblestone streets area, wooden sidewalks. And Gary was killing time before the show. And around the corner for me was one of those Western photo places where families could go in and you could dress up like the 1800s and get a picture took. So Gary went in. He got all decked out in this big flowing white dress. He put on the gloves. He had like that Sunday bonnet and he posed. They usually developed the pictures in like an hour or so back then. And he autographed it to me and he was just bored, but it was really a really special gift to me. And one, cause Gary was such a good friend. He wasn't really famous at the time. It was just such a funny gesture. So we put it on the wall of fame with all the 8x10s, you know, hey, it was to Scott, Gary Shandling, and he had some crass thing about, you know, wanting to be with me, something inappropriate, but we put it right up on the wall. Well, not 2 weeks later, I mean, really close, Bob Saget's working the club and he sees this and he's not going to be outdone. So he makes a point of going to the photo place, but he really goes crazy. He gets in one of those old school marm outfits with a big hoop dress and the bustier, and he had a big fancy hat. And he had not only the gloves, but he had a fan. And he just did this really funny pose. And, and he autographed it to my secret lover, Scott, you know, Bob Saget, something inappropriate, but it was an amazing gift and they're one of a kind. It's not like they mass produce these. So we put them up side by side on the wall of fame with all the 8x10s and they were there for over 20 years. Great guys, great gift that I took very passionately and was very, I had a lot of gratitude for that.
Yeah.
And it was their way of being funny, but also thanking me for, you know, what we were all doing together at that time in our lives.
That is the ultimate gift. That's a priceless gift.
Yeah. Yeah. And they can't be replaced. And it's I've been very blessed, Candace. I've had some great memories of you remember Soupy Sales. You're not as old as me, but Soupy Sales had a TV show, and he was famous for throwing pies in the faces of presidents and celebrities, Frank Sinatra, you name it. And it was a big thing. Soupy Sales would smash a pie in someone's face. Well, I had Soupy because I wanted to make my dad happy. I booked some of the older Catskills type of comics, and Soupy Sales came in, and I did a press deal at a car dealership, and I had a pie thrown in my face live on TV by Soupy Sales. And so I get to join the presidents and Sinatra and some of the other famous, John Wayne, that got a pie thrown in their face by this guy. So, I mean, those kind of moments, you'll never lose. They were just cherished and special. And I've been very blessed. But thanks for letting me share some of these stories with your listeners.
Oh, they've been good. This has been good. Okay, so let's just talk about marketing for a minute.
Sure.
You're old school. You've done it for years. You're old school. But in today, in 2023, what is your favorite marketing tool, tip, or technique?
Well, I hinted to it earlier. I still feel that the new entrepreneurs have been blessed with this free access to the public called social media. And if you use it correctly, there's no reason why you can't build a group, build an audience base, and be able to communicate with your customers, whoever it is, whether you're a restaurant, an art gallery, owner of a submarine, whatever you're doing. It's all about connecting and communicating with your customers. It used to be, you know, there were blogs and newsletters. Well, now it's social media groups, you know, a Facebook group or an Instagram group. But I also still believe, I think sadly that print is pretty much dead. You know, newspapers used to be a big, big part of our marketing back in the 80s and 90s. It's not, the value's not there anymore. Radio used to be huge. I think radio is a tough go these days. I still see some value in affordable TV advertising, and everybody goes, what? That's way too expensive. But let me tell you a little secret, Candace. These days, with the cameras we have on our phones and available to us, you can shoot a high enough quality commercial yourself, edit it on your Apple on iMovie, keep it about 59 seconds or 28, 29 seconds, run it over to your local Comcast or Xfinity office, and you can run TV ads for anywhere from 50 cents to a dollar.
Really?
Yep, I did it for years and nobody ever does it. And here's why. When you get to Comcast or Xfinity or wherever your local cable company, they're going to upsell you. They're going to say, well, you're going to want to run during the news hour. If you want this audience, you want to run between 4 and 6, right? Well, that's where they get you. I always said, no, I don't want any specific times. I don't want any specific anything. Here's some ads. You just run them when you can. Well, here's the secret about TV cable. There's, you know, I'll just round down. There's 400 channels. They all have 24 hours a day to fill, right? They all need commercials to cover them. And what these cable companies end up with is a lot of dead airtime that they have to fill. And what the audience doesn't know is a lot of times those are ads that people are getting for free or next to nothing because they have to fill the time. So I would take in my insurance days, I had 5 different commercials. I produced myself, very small investment, took them over to the local Comcast office and didn't let them upsell me. I said, I don't care when they run. I don't care what channel they run on. That's another thing. Oh, well, you want these on NBC or you know, Fox Sports. No, I don't care if it's on the Food Channel. Right? I don't care if it's on the History Channel. You just say, just run them wherever it fits. And you'll end up, you know, I think the most I ever paid for a spot was $10. But on average, it was 50 cents to a dollar. And they, you know, you give them a budget, $500 or something, and you might get 600 commercials aired for $500. I mean, it was, now you don't know who's seeing it. It's not necessarily going to drive people right to your doorstep, but it's all about branding.
Yeah.
Letting people know that, hey, you're Scott, the insurance pro.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and advertising on a podcast is also pretty inexpensive. Just saying.
No, it is. I'm a big believer in marketing and advertising. I advertise and market my podcast in different ways. Mopod is out there, you know, for $100, you get 133 guaranteed downloads or listeners. You know, that might be an investment that's good to somebody. Spotify just raised their rates. It's now a minimum of $1,000 investment for Spotify ads. And they're, these are all audio only ads. And I think that's a little pricey. So I don't do Spotify anymore. It used to be more affordable, but Castbox and Castro, there's a few other companies that for a very reasonable rate, you can reach podcast listeners that will help build your audience. Now, social media, we are all podcasters promote ourselves on social media, but you know, a very small percentage of social media watchers are podcast listeners. So I mentioned Mopod and Castro and Castbox and Spotify because now you're advertising to podcast listeners. A new one I just found, Candace, if you want to check it out, is have you seen the marketing app Headliner?
Yes, I use Headliner a lot.
Yeah, me too. Well, Headliner has a new marketing program where you can run ads on Headliner that reaches directly to podcasters.
And they kind of hold you. They hold you captive too,
yeah.
Because you have to listen to the ads while you're waiting for your video to render.
Exactly. So you know what I'm talking about. Well, that was, you know, another new and affordable way to get your podcast to podcast listeners. And so there's lots of options and I'm sure I'm missing quite a few, but
Candace, you gave a lot. The show notes are going to be so long for this episode. People, links to everything that Scott just mentioned will be in the show notes. GratitudeGeek.com. Just look for the episode with R. Scott Edwards.
Well, what I wanted to make sure that you and I covered is that I have a lot of gratitude for the life I've had and to being able to share it through your podcast, but also through my own podcast, which, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, stand-up comedy, your host and MC, available on all platforms. but my podcast about stand-up comedy is really a celebration of stand-up comedy. It's interviews with professionals. It's actual material from back in the 80s. I just launched one with Jazz Kaner, Robert Aguayo, and Dana Carvey doing musical comedy. A lot of people don't know Dana Carvey was a huge musician and did a lot of musical comedy on top of his impressions and The Church Lady and all that stuff. Podcasting has really been a gift to me, and I'm very appreciative of that. And I am so thankful, Candace, you give me an opportunity to share this with your listeners.
Well, I have two more questions for you. One of them is I alluded to it at the beginning and we never covered it. Please share about your video archive because I think that's fascinating.
Oh, well, thanks for asking. So I'm so into stand-up comedy that into podcasting, I formed my own podcast network. It's Stand-Up Comedy podcastnetwork.com. That's Stand-Up Comedy podcastnetwork.com. But if you go there, you'll find 18 different podcasts, all produced by stand-up comics. Now, they're not all comedy podcasts. In fact, one of them's really interesting about archaeology, but it's done and produced by a stand-up comic. So his name's David Strassman, one of the world's best comic ventriloquists. He's on tour in Australia right now. But he's into archaeology and he has this podcast that's amazing. But so there's 18 different podcasts. I do a lot of audio bites where you can hear segments of interviews and comedy. But one of the most fun things is what Candace is alluding to is I have a video archive where you can see Dana Carvey doing Chopping Broccoli a good 2 years before he was on Saturday Night Live, or Bob Saget live on stage. And by the way, this is the comedy Bob Saget, not the Danny Tanner daddy on Full House Bob Saget.
Yeah, and a lot of folks don't know that the comedy Bob Saget was pretty racy.
Yeah, he was a pretty edgy guy. Very funny, didn't drop F-bombs. He just talked about sex and other things and was hilarious. but it's different than the TV Bob that we all know. But, you know, Dave Coulier, I mentioned a few others, Jay Leno, they're all on there. In Paula Poundstone, when she first came out from Boston, was the only act in the history of my club that I let work multiple weeks as she kind of found her footing in comedy. And there's some great old video of Paula on stage. So, but there's a huge, we're mentioning some of the famous people. One of the things that people don't realize in comedy is that only like the rest of life, 1 or 2% get that golden ticket. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of very, very funny stand-up comics that no one's ever heard of. You know, the Tim Bedores, Jeff Jenna, Bruce Baum, you know, Steve Bruner, Mark Yaffe, that are out there performing, entertaining thousands of people every week, but you know, they're just not famous.
Yeah, but they're still funny.
Oh,
so I love going to live comedy, because you see people before you, when you go to live comedy shows in places that aren't San Francisco or Houston LA, or, you know, you're seeing the folks that haven't made it yet, that nobody's heard of yet. And so you see them when they're just at the beginning and they're starting to learn their craft, and you know, it's pretty funny.
My club's Laughs Unlimited were like that last step before fame. So we weren't an open mic house. We weren't a showcase room like some of the clubs. We were an actual, what's called a headliner A room. And then the next step was some sort of fame or road tour or TV, but we were very blessed. You said there was one other question you had.
Yes, I do. But I want to tell a story before I get to the last question.
Okay.
I used to work with a guy, and I'm not going to drop names, but there was a burgeoning comic. She was very funny, and she wasn't quite famous yet outside of the local area, but she was pretty famous within our local area. I mean, if we were in San Francisco, people in San Francisco knew who she was. Now she's international famous, but she used to tell jokes about him because he was her ex-boyfriend, and I worked with him. He was her ex-boyfriend, and she just wrote all of her jokes about him. So it's like, it was uncomfortable for him because he knew that she was talking about him.
Wow.
So there's actually somebody on the other side of most of those jokes, you know?
Well, you know, what a lot of people don't realize, and I'm going to get a little deep here on your audience, when comedy is really working well, you're relating to the audience. And how are you able to do that? There's always a little bit of truth.
Yeah.
In the joke, right? No matter how funny or satirical it might be, there's usually an underlining story or truth to it. And that's what makes it interesting. You know, if somebody was talking about something nobody ever knew about, I do a short story for people that Bill Maher, who's a pretty famous political comic, and could buy and sell me 10 times, very rich and successful, was one of the only comics I ever fired at my club. And it's because he went on stage on a Wednesday night, 40 people, 50 people in the audience, and he's doing all this political stuff, and he's talking over the heads of the audience. He was talking about naming legislative guys in DC. I'm in Sacramento, and we're a political town, but when you're talking about legislators in DC or other things about world politics, the audience wasn't getting it. They weren't laughing. He got pissed halfway through a show. He said, "You guys are just stupid here," and left the stage. I fired his ass right on the spot. Didn't pay him. I sent his ass home. But the reason was he forgot why he was there. An entertainer's job is to entertain the audience. They're there for the audience. The audience isn't there for the comic or the entertainer. And a lot of comics forget that. And that's my example of, you could talk about stuff that might mean something to you, but if you don't make it relatable to the audience, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. That's the theory behind podcasting too. You build the podcast that you enjoy, but make sure that you target an audience.
Right. You'll find your niche, right? You know, like I am passionate about stand-up comedy, but to a lot of the world, you know, they're not into it as much as me, but there's people like me that are really enjoy, you know, I have another podcast called Comedy Appetizers, where I edit down just 5-minute comedy bits.
Oh, so I love that.
Short form comedy, Comedy Appetizers, folks, check it out. But they're only like 5-6 minute chunks of comedy. And those, I think anybody could use a smile every day, right?
That's going on my playlist now. Comedy appetizers.
And the but my regular shows are anywhere from 40 minutes to 60 minutes because they're actual interviews or long form sets of comedy. And a lot of people have that kind of time. I mean, I think the interviews are educational and very funny. And the comedy sets are great. They're taken from, you know, live recorded shows. And you mentioned it in my opening. I did 3 TV series. I had an album or two. I did large concerts. I did Jay Leno in concert multiple years in a row. Jerry Seinfeld, Yakov Smirnoff, Dana Carvey, the Funny Boys all worked in my concerts. And I have all that material. I own it because I paid for it. I produced it. So now I'm able to share it. And that's the basis of my podcast. And it's great memories for me, but it bringing joy and comedy. And I'll just add that even though it's been 40 years, because I haven't been in the business for over 20 years, all this is from the 80s and 90s. It's still funny. Funny is funny.
Yeah. Well, and you said that your favorite marketing tooltip or technique was to utilize social media. But dude, your tool, your technique is repurposing. You are the ultimate repurposer.
I have my videos. I got my mini podcast. And I've written recently 2 books on stand-up comedy. So that's it. When you're semi-retired and retired and you have the time, but put it into your passion, right?
You are a purveyor of antique comedy.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great, I'm going to write that down. Purveyor of antique comedy.
And I'll send you a bill
for
that.
So true. She is right. Although antique comedy might turn off the younger folk, but like I said, funny is funny.
Vintage comedy.
It's really funny stuff. And that's a great name. So thank you for sharing.
You can pay me for that by doing an opener for my show.
Whatever you need, Candace.
I love it. All right.
You're a joy to listen to.
Oh, thank you. So last question. This is your moment of gratitude. For whom or what are you most grateful?
I mean, I thank God every day for the joy, the luck, the who I am, because I wouldn't have the adventures that I've experienced if I wasn't the type A personality, as my wife would say, pain in the ass guy that I am. But so I appreciate that those opportunities were afforded me just through who I was in my life. And then if there's a person I want to be grateful for, it is my wife. I was married briefly when I was young, 18 months of marriage, 18 years of payments, to give everybody an idea. Basically married a girl because she had my son, and I love my son and I'm still good friends with that gal. But it kind of turned me off to relationships early on. And then I met my bride Jill, and we dated because neither one of us were in a hurry to get married. We dated like 15 years, but we've now been married 24 years. So we've had a long time together, and through thick and thin, she's been my partner, my rock, and quite frankly, one of the few people that seems to enjoy putting up with my craziness, what we call my Piccadillys, I'm grateful for. So thank you for letting me share that to an audience.
Thanks for tuning in to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for solopreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. Make sure to visit gratitudegeek.com for the show notes, where you can find links to all the groovy resources we've mentioned, including ways to connect with our guest, R. Scott Edwards. If you love this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on Audible, iTunes, Good Pods, or your preferred podcast player so you never miss an episode.
Thank you for listening.
Our theme music is Track 14 by Rev Brock and Soul Lily. I'm your host, Candace Ridardi, reminding you that gratitude is like manure. It's just a pile of poo until you spread it around. Stay groovy, my friends.
Stay groovy, my friends.